This episode's sponsored by Good Ranchers. Most people don't realize this, but over 85% of the grass-fed beef sold in the U.S. is actually imported from overseas. It's a system that often pushes out American farmers and ranchers. That's why it matters to be intentional about where you buy your meat. That's why I choose Good Ranchers. Good Ranchers connects you directly with local American farms and ranches. 100% American meat, pasture-raised, no antibiotics, no added hormones. Delivered straight to your door. Make the switch to better meat. Go to goodranchers.com to start your plan and get premium American meat delivered right to your door. That's goodranchers.com. American meat delivered.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And welcome to Red Handed episode 13.
Lucky 13.
Lucky 13. We've had quite a week, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Leading up to lucky week 13. You guys have been fantastic. You've been leaving us so many five-star reviews. And you have no idea, or maybe you do, what a difference that makes to an independent podcast like us. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And also, Hannah, something weird happened to us again yesterday, didn't it?
Tracy Clayton tweeted us.
Unbelievable. How did she hear about us?
I don't know. Tracy Clayton is the co-host of BuzzFeed's Another Round podcast, and she's amazing.
Hilarious.
And she tweeted us yesterday, and I was at home in my pajamas, and Saruti was in the pub not looking at her phone. So I had like a minor panic attack in my room. Like, what do I do? What do I do?
Good.
But we got through it.
We did. We did. Should we get into the case?
We chose this case because we do so much research for you, our lovely listeners. Most of the coverage of the crimes that we look at focuses on the perpetrator rather than the victims. Like, for example, like, can you name all of Ted Bundy's victims or Jeffrey Dahmer's? Can you really? I think probably two or three max. So what really drew us into this case is that it's actually very hard to find information on it that isn't associated with one survivor. And we've touched on a couple of survivor stories before, but we wanted to cover a little bit of a less doom and gloom. Let's kick off. We start on the 27th of September 1992 in Desert Hot Springs, which is near Palm Springs in California. A 19-year-old Jennifer Aspinson was on her way to work at a home for disabled children. What follows is Jennifer's version of events. She was working the night shift at the home from 10 p.m. until 6 a.m. Since she had left her childhood home and due to her turbulent relationship with her mother, Jennifer was no longer allowed to use the family car. So she was waiting at the bus stop. Jennifer realised that she needed to buy something for work, and thinking she had plenty of time until the bus arrived, Jennifer quickly ran into the shop by the bus stop, and when she re-emerges, she realises that the last bus has gone without her, and she's stuck. Jennifer is alone at night in the California desert, with no way of getting to work. Worried about missing her shift, Jennifer stands by the side of the road, wondering what to do.
I mean, that's like absolute nightmare. You know, when you watch those American movies and they just have the long one road that goes through the desert for just miles and miles and miles, and either side of you is just desert. I mean, that's like Hills Have Eyes territory, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're quite, I mean, especially in London, we're quite spoiled because yeah. you can walk everywhere if you need to.
I mean, out there, you're just like, it's serial kids are hunting ground, or you're going to be eaten by like vultures.
Yeah, exactly. It's terrifying.
But then at this point, with Jennifer standing on the side of the road wondering what to do, a car pulls up and a man in his early 30s in the driver's seat asks Jennifer whether she needs a ride. Jennifer initially refuses, but has second thoughts, and with no other way of getting to work, she gets into the stranger's car. Now, whilst in the car, the man seems nice enough. Definitely not intimidating. This is a bit weird. He asks for Jennifer's number, and now starting to feel a little uneasy, Jennifer fake numbers him. I mean, of course you would. Why would you give him your real number? I mean, she's never going to see him again, right? But wrong. So very wrong. Because this man, he waited. That's right. He waited until her shift finished 8 hours later. Who does that? Let alone a stranger. My mum wouldn't do that for me. Oh, mum, just wait outside my work while I go in for an 8 hour shift. What the fuck? But you know, this really reminds me of like, you know, Ed Kemper. When he would like pick women up, and it was that thing of like pretending to be very affable and like getting luring them into your car. And the thing that terrifies me most about things like this in Ed Kemper was that Ed Kemper would even do dry runs where he would go pick up hitchhikers, not kill them, just to practice what it took to not freak a woman out in your car.
Oh, God, the chapstick in the door.
It's horrible. Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God, it's horrible. But this guy, maybe he pulled it off, but then she comes outside of work and he still sat there. And he offers her a ride home. And hesitantly, Jennifer accepts. And the pair drive in silence for a little while, when suddenly the man grabs Asperson's head and smashes it into the dashboard and holds a gun to her. Jennifer recalls knowing at this moment, he's going to hurt me. If he wasn't going to kill me, he's definitely going to rape me. Her attacker now pulls the car over and turns off the engine. Still with the gun to her head, he cuts Jennifer's shorts and underwear off while repeatedly punching her in the head. He tries to force her to perform oral sex, but she refuses.
Furious, he then attempted to rape Jennifer, but he couldn't get it up, which obviously just makes him even more angry. This is where it gets even more twisted. Her attacker forced Jennifer to tell him that she loved him.
Ugh, no. Ugh.
Just makes me feel sick. Which she did, but not convincingly enough. And he hit her and said, "You're a lying bitch, say it like you mean it."
However she said it, he wouldn't believe it because he is clearly a man riddled with deep-seated insecurity and, you know, inadequacy.
He grabbed her underwear and shoved them in her throat. Jennifer recalls later that she could feel the sides of her mouth split. She said that she had tried to say that she loved him, but she had her knickers in her mouth, so obviously she couldn't. And in an attempt to save herself, Jennifer tries to choke the underwear out of her mouth, but doesn't quite manage it. Her attacker grabs her by the throat and starts strangling her. Jennifer loses consciousness. She comes to as he's violently shaking her, possibly in an attempt to wake her up. He then opens the car door, and Jennifer, seeing her chance, makes a break for it. But she doesn't get far. Her attacker pulls her back to the car by her hair, and at this point, seeing no way out, Asperson begs him to kill her, knowing he's done this before.
He now ties her hands behind her back with string and crams her into the boot of the car. Jennifer laid there, and in desperation, she prayed to God, "If there is any God, let me die or let me get away." Jennifer describes what happens next as nothing less than divine intervention. I think it may be likely to be a result of more like hysterical strength, like adrenaline coursing through your body. You do find the ability to, you know, do something like this. But either way, Jennifer hears the string binding her wrist together popping. It breaks and her hands are now free. Knowing she may not have much time, and in total darkness, Jennifer begins to feel around the boot of the car and she finds a lock mechanism and manages to pop the boot open while the car is moving. He sees this though and starts shouting. He pulls over and he slams the boot door shut. But if Jennifer could do it once, she could do it again. He got back in the car and got stuck in the soft sand at the side of the road, seizing her chance. Knowing it was her last chance, Jennifer got out of the trunk barefoot and naked from the waist down and she runs. Her attacker runs down the road after her, wielding a machete. Jennifer keeps running, not looking back, and that's when she sees a truck.
The truck stops, and there are two Marines in the cab. She screams, that guy, he was trying to kill me. But the car was gone. He had sped off. The Marines took Jennifer to a petrol station, where they called the police. But with no witnesses, there was very little they could do for her. The Marines hadn't even seen the car. So for them, they hadn't seen this man running down the road wielding machete. They'd just seen this distraught woman on the side of the road. So they couldn't even tell the police, "We saw him. We saw this car. That's what he looked like." I'm not convinced that. The reasons for this will become a little bit clearer as we go on, but I just don't think at this point the police believed a word she was saying. And after this, things would go downhill for Jennifer.
You know, he'd smashed her face in, done all of this. She'd had her arms bound. So you can see all of that. And see, obviously, she was running down the road half naked. I know, obviously, the Marines didn't see the car. But is it weird that the police don't believe her? Why do you think that is, that they didn't believe this woman?
I mean, they could see from the state of her that something had happened. Mm-hmm. So I think it was very obvious that something had happened to her, but they had no witnesses, they had no car, they had no weapon. There was very little that they could go on at this point. Poor Jennifer, like, her life really starts to spiral out of control. She was understandably terrified of everything and unable to shake the knowledge that this stranger who had abducted her and attempted to rape and murder her knew her name.
Oh my God.
And he knew where she lived because he was driving her home, so she must have
told
him.
And knows where she works.
This is where my house is. So unable to cope, Jennifer started to self-harm and she slowly lost touch with reality and she was eventually sectioned. This is horrible. Even her family didn't believe her.
That's so sad.
And her mother simply told the police that Jennifer was a storyteller. For the next 4 years, Jennifer Aspenson lived in mental hospitals, constantly asking herself, what had I survived for? Have I just made it all up? Or did it even happen?
Jennifer was eventually released from residential care, but with little supportive network around her, she struggled to adapt back into normal life. Until 1997, that was. So 5 years after Jennifer was abducted and attacked, a policeman knocked on her door. He had with him pictures of men. He laid them out on the table and said, tell me if they look familiar. Instantly, she identified the man who attacked her. The police officer paused and said, this is the man who killed 8 women, and you are the only one who got away. Okay, how do they know she's the only one who got away?
This is why I said at the beginning, this is Jennifer's version of events.
Yeah, okay, yeah, because, okay, we'll come on to this later, but don't you think it all just, it sounds a little bit at the moment, almost like a movie?
Yeah, but the facts are, she was able to, from these pictures given to her by a policeman, she was able to identify the man who did all of these awful things to her, and it was this man.
As sort of strange as the story sounds, like you said, she was absolutely able to correctly identify that the man that they were holding, who they had proven to have killed all these women. This man was Andrew Eurydiles. He had been arrested in Illinois on the 23rd of April 1997 on suspicion of the murders of Lori Ulaki, 25 years old, Lynn Huber, 22 years old, and Cassandra Corum, 21 years old. Lori had been found naked with her hands bound with duct tape, stabbed and shot in Wolf Lake on the Illinois-Indiana border on the 14th of April 1996. Her bloody clothes had been discarded in bins nearby. Cassandra Corum's body was found on the 14th of July 1996 in the Vermilion River. Cassandra had also been stabbed and shot in the head. And on the 2nd of August 1996, Lynn Huber's body had been found in Wolf Lake. She had also been stabbed and shot. Her clothes had also been thrown away in the same way as Laurie's, in nearby bins. Laurie and Lynn both had previous convictions for prostitution, but Cassandra didn't. All three of these women had been killed with a Smith & Wesson 38 revolver. Now, this is a really very common firearm. I mean, there are literally millions of them in the United States, so it doesn't really narrow down anything. But you can see that the MO is really similar. They were stabbed, they were shot, naked, found in a similar area, with their clothes discarded in nearby bins. In April 1997, so months after Laurie and Lynn had been found in Wolf Lake, police received a 911 call from an anonymous sex worker in a seedy hotel in Cook County. She reported that she had been with Andrew Eurydiles, and he had wanted to bind her hands with duct tape, put her in the boot of his trunk, and drive her to Wolf Lake. She had refused, and Eurydiles had become violent. This call out happened 1 month before Cassandra Corum. Body was found dumped in Vermilion River, just an hour from Wolf Lake.
In November 1996, Eurydiles was pulled over during a routine traffic stop. He was carrying a Smith & Wesson 38 revolver that he did not have a license for. This is the biggest stroke of luck for the police. The gun was seized, tested, and found to be the gun that fired the bullets that killed Lynn, Laurie, and Cassandra. So they had the murder weapon. They knew from this call out at the hotel, he's got form. Andrew Eurydiles came willingly to the police station after being arrested outside his home where he lived with his parents, as they took him in for questioning, as long as the police agreed to give him a ride to work afterwards. I think Andrew Eurydiles is a bit of a simple soul, I think.
Do you think, or do you think he just thought, they've got nothing, let's go?
The police opened with questions about the unlicensed firearm that had been seized during the traffic stop, asking Eurydiles whether he had ever let anyone else use it. Eurydiles stated that he was the only one to ever use the gun and that he was always careful to lock it up in a tackle box in his basement. He was the only one who had a key. Why would he tell him that? It just shows that he's just not that smart. I don't think he's trying to deceive the police. I think he genuinely just doesn't connect the two things.
It is very strange that he's so open about saying that. I mean, I don't understand why he says that. It's almost like trying to please them by being like, look what a responsible gun owner I am. I keep it locked up in a box in my basement and no one else ever has access to it. I haven't done anything wrong.
Apart from not having a license and whoops, you already have me for that. Like, I think...
I don't know. It's weird. And I've been murdering women with it.
You could look at it two ways. Like, you could look at it as him just being a bit simple, possibly. Or you could go completely the other way and be like, he's so cocky and arrogant. Perhaps he'd never even considered getting caught because the women he was murdering were, almost all of them were sex workers. So maybe he just thought no one would miss them. So it couldn't possibly be connected. So then the police drop the bomb. They tell Andrew Eurydiles that his firearm is without doubt the weapon that killed Lynn Ulaki, Laurie Huber, and Cassandra Corum. and that is all it took. Eurydiles loosened his tie, he untied his shoes, and he said, I guess I'm not going to work today. And then he said, I think you might want to call California.
This is so strange, the way that he says this. I can almost just imagine him loosening his tie, untying his shoes and saying, well, I guess I'm not going to work then. But that thing, does that scream of like someone who's incredibly simple and just going along with it? Or is it someone who's like, it's almost quite like maniacal? I don't know. It's like almost because you don't know the tone with which it was said. It's really hard to know how it's meant and what that means about his character. And then the arrogance of, well, not the arrogance or the whatever it is of being like, you might also want to call California. Do you know what I mean? Like, if it's said like that, it's very sinister.
It is sinister, but it's also like, if you're... I feel like he doesn't really fit into this... You know, he's not a Robert Hansen. He's not someone who's trying to conceal it. But then I'm not sure whether it's because he's proud of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. It's like a disconnect in that sense. And I don't know. Sometimes, you know, they also say when the police catch someone who is a killer... Sometimes like this, there's also an overwhelming sense of relief for that killer sometimes. I've been caught. It's all over. I don't have to stop pretending. I don't have to stop running. I'm done. And it's almost that very, very like symbolic thing of the pressure is off. He loosens his tie. He takes his shoes off. He's like, I've been caught. I'm done. When they catch a guilty man, he'll usually fall asleep. When they catch an innocent man, he's the one that's awake all night. He seems chill to me, almost like, it's over.
Because like Illinois and California, that is far. I don't think they would ever have been connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
If he hadn't have said this just now.
No, I don't think they ever would have been connected. But it gets even weirder. So his confessions that he gives are so detailed. He remembers what each of his victims was wearing, down to like the colour of their socks. Eurydiles gave a full confession to the 3 murders he was suspected of and 5 further murders in California. And the murder and attempted rape of Jennifer Asbenson. These memories, these confessions, they were his trophies, almost. That's how it feels. He remembers them to such a detail and holds them so close to him. It does seem like they're his trophies. It's very bizarre. So let's start at the beginning. We're going to be backtracking quite a few years, so stay with us. We'll take you through Eurydiles' atrocities in chronological order. He confessed to these crimes in excruciating detail, detailing exactly how they were killed and where he disposed of their bodies. Now, 6 years before Jennifer Asbenson's attempted rape and abduction on the 18th of January 1986, Eurydiles was a Marine. He was stationed at Camp Pendleton in California. And now just a quick background check on him. He had grown up in a very violent home. Oh, this is horrible. His mother would keep a belt in the freezer to beat him with. And what the fuck? His sister molested him throughout his childhood, and he's even sustained several injuries during childhood that required hospital stays.
The sister molestation is alleged. That was used by his defence in trial.
In defence, okay. Alleged molestation by his sister then. So Eurydiles joined the Marine Corps straight out of high school, but probably not out of patriotism. He did it to kill. He was viciously bullied at school by his peers, who branded him as gay. And I think Eurydiles felt like becoming a Marine, the epitome of manliness, was his way of proving them wrong. This isn't the only classic serial killer trait we see in Eurydiles.
He ticks so many boxes, it is insane. It's the classic abusive home, injury, sexual abuse, and then the military. And I do wonder whether... Obviously, we're not saying that everyone who is in the military in America comes out as a serial killer. That's not what we're saying. Let's just get that out of the way. But I do wonder if there is a correlation between whether it's similar to the amount of men who come out of the military and then go on to be serial killers. Is it in any way similar to the percentage of Catholic priests that go on to be child abusers?
I don't know. It's like those certain types of jobs attract certain type of people. And I think that... With the paedophilia in the Catholic Church, it's very much like hiding in plain sight. Who could possibly suspect this lovely priest? And it is very much, it's a cover, isn't it? And that's why they did it. And also free access to all these choir boys and all of these children's homes, anything you want to do. And I think when it comes to the army, I think it, or the Marines or anything like that, military service, and we've seen it time and time again, it's not just that. It's even Edmund Kemper, he wanted to be a police officer, but he couldn't be. BTK, he wanted, you know, a uniform. He wanted to be, have that position of power, that position of authority. Lots of these men, like John Wayne Gacy, he was closeted homosexual. He didn't want to be gay. So it was, what can I do to assert maximum level of like manliness so that nobody suspects any of these things? And lots of these serial killers, we know they deal with huge feelings of inadequacy. And so what better way to overcome a feeling of like not being manly enough, a feeling of inadequacy, than to be in a job that screams of alpha male?
Yeah, I totally agree. Have you seen Deliver Us From Evil?
No, I don't think I have.
It's an incredible documentary, but about this one particular priest who is a serial child abuser. And they're in that documentary, there is a seminary in upstate New York, and 13% of the priests who come out of that particular seminary went on to be sex offenders. And they say in the document, if 13% of the people who came out of Yale went on to be sex offenders, Yale would get shut the fuck down. And the way they explored it in the documentary is to do with, you go into a seminary usually when you're about 16, 17, and that is when your sexual development stops, because you're in the church already. So I wonder whether there is a parallel between training as a Catholic priest, making it more likely for you to be attracted to young children, in a similar way as going into the army at a young age makes you more likely to be a killer, perhaps. I wonder.
That's interesting about the Catholic priests. I think that's really interesting because of them going in so young, and then that maybe like an arrested sexual development, and then that leads to sex offence. And I also wonder, if you are going into seminary school, you've probably been around the church your entire life. And we do know, sadly, that many people who are sexually abused go on, like a lot of that high percentage of that, sadly do go on to also be abusers. Maybe that happens to them as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's obviously, it's such a multifaceted thing. I just thought it was a bit of an interesting parallel.
No, but I think absolutely, I think with the Catholic Church, absolutely, I find that really interesting. With the army and the military, I think it is, there's also an element of obviously PTSD, and people come back, different people, that level of trauma can obviously lead to, not serial killers, but you know, deep-seated issues. With this, I think it is more that certain types of characters are drawn to that type of role. So people will either join out of a sense of duty, out of patriotism, out of wanting to make a difference. And then there will be the sick fucks that join because they get to kill with impunity. Not that that's what the army is there for, but that's what they think that they can go to.
I think you've got it spot on there. And also, there's another classic serial killer trait that Andrew Yuridiles displays in his childhood. When he was 13, he beat his family dog to death with a baseball bat.
Ugh.
Abusing animals when you're a child is so common amongst serial killers.
This is the thing I find really interesting, because I was actually talking about this just last night. Somebody was talking about, you know, the McDonald triad, where it's like animal abuse, bedwetting, and fire starting. And I read somewhere actually, because obviously so much of the belief is obviously that children who portray those signs maybe have some sort of like, you know, psychopathy, sociopathy. Moving into adulthood, they'll probably become violent, potentially turn into serial killers. I read somewhere, it's quite interesting, that actually that isn't the link, and you shouldn't look at those three things as an indicator of someone who's going to go on to be violent. You should look at those three things in a child and say that those three things are happening as a symptom of abuse, and the abuse is what leads them to go on to become violent killers. So it's almost like just looking at that and the link to what they will become, you're missing the crucial step in that the reason that is showing itself as a symptom in that child is because they're probably being abused. Because if you think about it, violence against animals, arson and bedwetting, think about them not related to serial killerness, but think about that as that really makes sense as three symptoms that you might see in a child that's being abused.
Oh, that is so interesting.
The anger, the rage that they will feel. Let me take it out on this animal that can't defend, can't fight back. I'll set this fire because that's the anger showing itself. And the bedwetting is that vulnerable side of them that something horrible is happening to them. Do you know what I mean? And then it's actually the abuse. No. So we've gone off on a bit of a tangent. So let's bring it back to Yuridiles.
We don't know too much about Yuridiles' time in the Marines, but something happened one night in January 1986 when he was stationed at Camp Pendleton in California. Something that humiliated him completely, and it's only ever referred to as an unexplained incident. Yuridiles left the base furious, looking for revenge, and he pulled over to Saddleback Community College. And he sees 23-year-old Robin Bradley walking across the car park. Robin was working at a concert and at the end of her shift, but before she could make it across the car park, she was grabbed by Yuridiles and he stabbed her 41 times and left Robin to bleed to death.
41 times?
On the tarmac. He just wanted to kill someone weaker than him. I think that's what that was.
Oh, absolutely. And the overkill, 41 times. Imagine how long that would take to stab someone 41 times.
Robin's body was found the next day by a security guard. The police had no explanation at all. Her keys and her handbag were right next to her body, so it couldn't have been a robbery. It just seemed like a totally random act, which in a sense, it kind of was. Again, the police had absolutely nothing, no murder weapon, nothing to identify the killer, and no witnesses. Robin's parents went on the hunt with a PI, but no substantial leads were found, and police gave up, and the case went cold.
Next year, Dallas confessed to the murder of Julie McGee, a sex worker whose body had been discovered on the 17th of July 1988. She had been shot dead in a remote area of Cathedral City, California. Again, there was virtually no evidence found at the scene of the crime. Eurydales was stationed at 29 Palms in California at the time, and on the 25th of September 1988, Mary Ann Wells, 31, was found shot dead in San Diego. On the 5th of April 1989, 18-year-old Tammy Irwin was found shot dead in Palm Springs. And on the 11th of March 1995, Denise Maney, 32, was found dead in Palm Springs, California. She had been tied up with string, tortured, and shot. Eurydales confessed to each of these murders. Mary Ann and Tammy were both also sex workers. It's quite a span of ages that he's covering. And all of his victims look really different. He just wanted to kill women. It's so indiscriminate. It's so random. It didn't matter who they were or what they looked like. I don't think he had any kind of like moral thing, like maybe like Robert Hansen and some people that we see, they go after sex workers because he says, oh, they're a plague on society or whatever. I think this guy was just going after easy prey. Anybody he could get his hands on.
That's exactly what I think.
Absolutely, like a total opportunistic predator. Whoever he could get, as long as they were a woman, I'm going to kill you. That level of rage and anger towards women, do we think probably stemming back from his childhood and his hatred of his mother and his sister for whatever happened?
We don't know 100% what went on, but I think his hatred of women, if that's what this is, which I think it probably is, will have stemmed from the abuse he suffered at the hands of his mother and his sister at home.
And the reason also he stays away from the radar of the police, I don't think it was on purpose, his like randomly shifting MO, but it definitely helped keep him safe and keep him undetected. Because again, like I said, his MO shifts backwards and forwards, sometimes stabbing, sometimes shooting, sometimes both. One he would tie with string, the next he would duct tape, then it would go back to string. The MO is not defined enough to point towards a serial killer. No one spotted the pattern. There was no question of a serial killer at the time each of the bodies were discovered. Once Eurydales moved back to Chicago after his frustrating stint in the Marine Corps, he appeared to be a fully functioning member of society. He was even a union rep.
That means people trust you.
Oh, absolutely. You were voted into a position like that.
Yeah, exactly. That's like people trust you. People you work with trust you enough to represent them at union meetings. Like,
but ex-Marine... It fits with that, doesn't it? This kind of, again, lends itself to me feeling like he's not stupid, that he is quite manipulative and maniacal. But however, he revealed to the police that he would go on vacation to California with the express purpose of finding a woman to kill. I mean, that is... And look as well, how far out of his comfort zone he is willing to take himself to kill. That is very, very premeditated and that is very cunning.
But he knows California though because that's where he was stationed. So it's not really out of his comfort zone. It's just away from his family.
But look at what the effort he will go to leave his home in Chicago, to go all the way to California just to kill. But couple that with how opportunistic he is. That's very weird. I'll plan to go all the way to California, but I'll kill randoms. That's very strange.
He's so all over the place.
He even had a locker in Palm Springs. I mean, again, this is so organized, where he kept his murder kit. Knives, fake license plates from different states, duct tape, string, everything he needed for his spree. He is such like a combination of contradictions when you think of what as the mind of a serial killer is like. He's 1 minute organized, 1 minute disorganized. Unless it's like the ultimate organization and then going after randoms because it's less traceable. I mean, if you were going to kill someone, hypothetically speaking, you kill someone you don't know. You kill someone with no link to you. You kill total strangers. Kill absolute randoms that you can't connect to each other even. Is he just super smart?
Oh, I don't know now. I changed my mind a bit, I think.
He's gone from a dullard to a, like, criminal genius. I don't know. But perhaps if he had just continued in California and not in Illinois, he never would have even been caught, I think.
I don't think he would ever have been connected to the California cases had he not slipped up in Illinois. Because what gave him away were the identical circumstances with Lynn Huber and Laurie Ulacki. They were both found in Wolf Lake months apart. And he's really shortening his cooling off period, because we're finding the ones he has admitted to, that they're years apart, and then it slowly gets shorter and shorter times till it's just months.
That's so classic, isn't it? We just see that time and time again with they'll try their first kill, then it will sustain them for quite a while, and then they won't need to kill again for months. And then that time will just shorten and shorten and shorten as they sort of rapidly kind of devolve.
He also confesses to abducting Jennifer Aspenson. He remembers exactly what she was wearing, where he picked her up, where she worked. He said that he tied her hands, strangled her, and put her in the trunk. He remembered the trunk popping open while he was driving and her running out of the car. And he said he just drove off. He does not confess to tracing her down the road with a machete. The police have absolutely nothing to tie him to these murders or to Jennifer, and he just gives it away. Eurydiles stands trial in Cook County, Illinois, for the murders of Lynn and Laurie, the Wolf Lake murders. Eurydiles recants his confession and pleads not guilty. What? Why?
It doesn't make any sense.
That's such a bizarre thing to do when you have given such a perfect, detailed confession. They know that the murder weapon is yours. It just makes absolutely no sense to then go into a court of law and plead not guilty. Jennifer Aspenson took the stand in this trial. That's brave, man. I don't know if I'd be able to do that. And she told the jury all about her abduction, her torture, and her escape. She also confronted Eurydiles' family with a TV crew outside the courthouse, which does make me feel a little bit uncomfortable.
It's really weird. This is quite strange.
If it was just her on her own and wanting to seek some sort of closure, that I could understand. The fact a TV crew is there. Jennifer Aspenson she's just a very intense person. And you can find this footage on YouTube, and she's shouting at the Eurydiles family, asking how their son could have done this. Andrew Eurydiles' sister eventually runs up to Jennifer and hugs her and saying she doesn't know, but she is so sorry. Yeah, the TV crew being there just made it feel a little bit predatory, I think.
If the TV crew are there being their usual predatory selves, you know, that I can kind of get that they're doing that for the shot. If Jennifer Aspenson has orchestrated this situation where she can yell at the family in front of the TV crew, that's very bizarre. But we don't know if she's just shouting and the TV crew happens to be there.
It was a TV show that she had taken to the trial.
Oh, okay. Back to the trial. Eurydiles changed his plea to insanity. I guess that makes sense. So he confessed, pleads guilty, tells them all the stuff, and then in court he pleads not guilty. I'm guessing he's trying to build a case for not guilty by reason of insanity. So it's not guilty, but he's saying he's insane. So the jury find him guilty in just 3 hours, and he was sentenced to death. He later stood trial for the murder of Cassandra Corum in Livingston County, where he originally pled not guilty, but changed his plea to insanity in the early days of the trial again. His defense now presented an MRI scan and a SPECT scan of Eurydiles' brain, claiming that he had either been born with or had sustained brain damage. Again, just another seriously classic serial killer trait. The number of serial killers that have serious head injuries as children. If he was being abused, that's not beyond the realms of possibility that something like that happened.
He went to hospital a lot as a kid. Also, like a SPECT scan is that it measures the blood flow in your brain.
And Dr. Mary Kangas, the doctor that the defense had brought in, stated also that instead of a 39-year-old, his brain looked more like the brain of a 70 or 80-year-old. The SPECT scan displays, as Hannah just said, poor blood flow to Eurydiles' temporal lobes. And that area of the brain is what affects memory and emotional control and regulates behaviour and understanding of other people's emotions. It's like the prefrontal cortex is where your conscience lives, as well as your ability to communicate and engage with others. So that is why you see so many serial killers who have head injuries. It's almost like it creates a psychopath, which is very interesting.
Yeah, or
but
triggers
this was
one.
Their defense. Yeah, or triggers something that's underlying. And it's almost like, yeah, a strong smack on the head could just turn that off. Imagine just living one day without any empathy or any remorse or any guilt associated to anything you did. it would be a very strange thing to understand.
It is, but like, I think I've got a little bit too much empathy. Like, if I have to watch cartoons because I can't watch real people because I will, like, ascribe empathy to them.
You're an empath.
I am. It's hard. Like, if I've had a bad day, I'm like, I can't watch real people today. I'm going to have to watch The Simpsons.
Oh, man. No, I'd say I'm not quite there, but I'm also not quite on Eurydice's level, glad to say. So yes, this was what the defense were building their case around. And Merikangas compares MRIs of Eurydice's brain with those of a normal man about the same age. Eurydice's cortex, where, now this is weird, we're not quite sure if this is a real thing, but Merikangas says it's where the major thought cells are. And his appear to have been severely shrunk.
Major thought cells does not sound like a real thing.
I know, and I have a friend who studied neuroscience at university, so I did text her before we started recording to be like, hey, Sarah, major thought cells, is that a thing? They sound super fake. But she's in Dubai at the moment, and I don't think she's seen it, and she hasn't replied. But hey, we'll find out from her if major thought cells are a real thing, and we'll post something on Instagram once she does get back to me. Oh, so Eurydice now was shown to have lost a large portion of his brain. The rest of his brain had apparently then expanded to fill the gap. Again, we're not experts, but this is what the doctor that his defense team had brought in was stating and claiming to the court. But still, Eurydice was found guilty. But the death penalty was abolished in Illinois in 2011, so his sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. 3 life sentences, one for each of the Illinois murders that he had committed. And in the same year, Eurydice was then extradited to California to stand trial for the 5 murders and the abduction and attempted rape of Jennifer Aspenson. He is due to stand trial later this year. It was scheduled to begin in September, but it's been delayed.
I actually found this out watching a Louis Theroux documentary about prisons. In America, if you are in prison and you're waiting to stand trial, you by law have to have a trial date. That trial date means nothing. It can be moved years and years in advance. It can be moved at the drop of a hat. You just need to have one or they can't hold you in prison.
You know, what they do when they take you to Guantanamo Bay, you've got no trial, there's no trial scheduled. So it's got to be proof, I think, under the Constitution that you're in court and you're awaiting trial and you have a set date for when that is going to happen.
And what's interesting is that in California, the death penalty still stands. So if he is found guilty of the California murders, he could face the death penalty, which he has escaped in Illinois. So as we've talked about, like his MO just shifted around and that probably kept him out of police custody for years. But I did hear him described as not your average serial killer because he was learning as he went along and changing his methods. What is an average serial killer?
I guess they mean an average serial killer, someone who has a very fixed MO, a very fixed signature. This is what I do. This is what gets me off for whatever reason. So, you know, like look at someone like Ted Bundy. He had a very, very specific type. This is the kind of woman that I want to murder because of this girl who humiliated me, and I kill them the same way. I have a very strong MO and a very strong signature. I guess that's what they mean by average serial killer.
Yeah, I think you're right. Actually, I should stop being Snarkzilla. It's hard. What is very interesting, though, so Robin Brandley is obviously one of the California killings that Eurydice still has to stand trial for. Robin Brandley's family don't believe that Andrew Eurydice was acting alone. They have a website called whomurderedrobinbrandley.com, and they state that they think a female student also at Saddleback Community College was involved in Robin's murder. The Brandley family believe that the investigation into Robin's murder was bungled from the start with just really basic stuff. Stuff like the police didn't have the sprinklers turned off in the car park where Robin's body was found.
Oh, for God's sake.
I mean, no wonder they found no evidence then. It's all been washed away. So,
I mean, what the fuck?
They also claim that although Eurydice does confess to Robin's murder, he repeatedly uses the word we when describing murdering Robin, but he doesn't do this with the other murders. The prosecution do pick up on this use of the word we, and he says he at one point. So he says we and he says he, but only when he's talking about Robin. And the prosecution asks Eurydice whether he was acting alone, and he responds with surprise, and he's like, yes, I was on my own. And Robin's family claim that this was not fully explored because the police were eager to cover up the mistakes on the case in the early days, like the not collecting evidence probably, and etc., they were just like, great, we have our man, it was him, done.
And in the tapes of his confessions, Uridali speaks almost as if, though, the knives and the guns were acting of their own accord. So maybe when he's talking about he, is he talking about his weapon? His use of the word we speaks more to like a total level of detachment from the actions rather than to an accomplice. He doesn't strike me as the kind of man that's like tag team, double act. He is dealing with serious levels of inadequacy and anger and rage. He seems like a one-man band. But let's come back to Jennifer. Now, Jennifer has appeared on multiple talk shows telling her story, telling the story of her abduction and her attempted rape and her escape. She even now has her own YouTube channel. And we have to say that it is weird. I mean, we really want you guys to go. We'll post some of the videos on our Facebook discussion group. This isn't victim blaming. This is nothing like that. But you have to watch the channel. You have to watch the videos to understand how weird it is. It's a mixture of things. Mostly, they're instructional videos on how to escape various situations. There's one like how to escape a home invasion, for example. There's also one called how to escape zip ties behind your back like a boss. And these mainly consist of her dressed up slightly dominatrix-esque and then getting someone to cover her in duct tape or tie her hands behind her back. And then it cuts to like black and white. And then she'll have like a scared look on her face and then she'll escape. It is really strange. And there's also another one where she covers her mouth with duct tape and attempts to get it off without using her hands. And this one is extra weird because she's accompanied by her very young niece.
Yeah, it's like a competition between them. They both have duct tape on their faces and they're racing to see who can get it off first.
That's really weird. And we love a good emoji, we do, but there are so many knife emojis everywhere all over this channel. It seems very odd. Now, there are also some not crime related videos, which I found even weirder, where Jennifer writes these like short quote unquote funny monologues and then performs them to the camera. Some of them include things like, I ate the divorce papers. That's what that video is called. And it consists of her, like, bleary-eyed, I think looking a little bit drunk, with some sheets of paper, playing a character who's got, like, a weird fake British accent, talking to a person called Charles, just eating paper.
It's so unsettling.
It really is. And there's another one called Confronting Johnny Depp, and another one called My Hot Body Secret Revealed. But the one that really spun me out, because I'm quite hungover today. What happened this morning was just to prepare myself, get myself in the right mindset before we started recording this case. I decided to just go back and watch one of these videos. And I came across one called Storytime, the true story of when I almost accidentally abducted a small black child. And this is on Jennifer Aspenson's YouTube video. You can go watch it. Surreal isn't even the word. It's one of the strangest things I've ever watched. I mean, it would give, like, I don't know, Donnie Darko a run for its money. It's so strange. She's telling the story of, like, how she accidentally ended up with, again and again, she got, like, the small black child. Talking about how this child just burst into her house. He's got scars all over his body. And then she's trying to justify why she didn't call the police or anything like that. She repeatedly tells you it's a true story. And she's telling you all the things that happened while that child was at her house. But it's like cut, 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 because it looks like it's been filmed over a couple of days and it's all been cut and pasted together. And then there's random words flash across the screen. She again seems like she's been drinking, or maybe she's like a bit spaced out. It's a very weird story. So either it's real and she handled a very bizarre situation like that incredibly oddly, or it's not real, and she's got a very intense imagination. Go watch it. I'll post that one on the Facebook group.
There's hours of entertainment to be had on Jennifer Aspenson's YouTube channel.
It's whether it's entertainment, although it's like very, very, the recordings of a very sadly ill woman. She doesn't seem well to me.
No, I don't.
In those videos. But she has fans. She has loads of fans. I read the comments. People are like, hey, could you show us how to escape from zip ties next? Like, people are watching this and really, maybe she is helping them. When she was wondering, you know, what did I survive this for? What purpose did I survive this for? Maybe to some people she is serving a purpose, because people are watching these videos, commenting, is enjoying the right word? Gaining something from it.
I don't know, it's so hard to like pick the correct terminology for this. Like, I really feel like I'm on eggshells. Jennifer has also recreated escaping from a car boot on a daytime TV show, and most famously on the 24th anniversary of her abduction, so January 2017, this year, Jennifer went back to the area of Desert Hot Springs where she was abducted and live streamed for an hour telling her story. And this is not edited at all, it's just her talking straight for an hour. She said that she wanted her viewers to be there with her in real time and wanted them to hear everything in her own words without interruption. And you can find it on YouTube. It's actually pretty, that's quite difficult to watch, that one. Jennifer demonstrates how she was bound and she takes you through the whole experience of her abduction. Jennifer has dedicated her life to doing something extraordinary and she feels like she has escaped death for a reason. Her Twitter bio starts with, "Jennifer is the only survivor of one of the most prolific serial killers to date." So I guess she's turned it into a win, kind of.
Absolutely. Neither of us are saying that what happened to Jennifer didn't happen, because you cannot refute the facts. He confessed to it and she correctly identified him from a lineup of 10 men. She had everything she said was corroborated by him in his confession, apart from the thing about the machete.
Yes, it absolutely happened. What I would recommend you watch to really get a feeling for what we're trying to touch on here is watch Jennifer Aspinson on the Justin Root Show. It's half an hour and that will really, it will make it clear, I think.
All we're saying here is that this absolutely happened to Jennifer, but that she's just not very well. Maybe turning this into a win is good for other people, that they're hearing this inspirational story of how this woman escaped, but I wonder what detriment to her mental health all this fame comes with.
Jennifer still lives in California with her 20-year-old daughter and is in the process of writing a book about her ordeal. She's confirmed that she will testify at the California trial in 2017 and that she will push for the death penalty.
So we'll keep an eye out for when that eventually happens, as the date's been pushed back, and we'll keep you guys posted on any updates.
So yeah, that's our survivor. That's Jennifer Aspinson.
Thank you to everyone who's left us a 5-star review. It makes such a big difference. So please, guys, keep them coming. If you're listening, just take 2 seconds to, you know, pop us down a quick review. And we'll be back next time.
Yeah, and come to the pub on the 30th.
We'll see you then. Bye.
See you later. Bye.